This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code SPOTIFY for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
What does motion sound like? With Kizikans free shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Eastern European Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Eva Glišić, the host of the channel. Today, we'll be talking to Orly Friedman about her new book, Memory Activism and Digital Practices After Conflict, Unwanted Memories. Orly Friedman is Associate Professor at the Faculty of Media and Communications at Singidun University in Belgrade, where she has the Center for Comparative Conflict Studies. She's also the Academic Director of the School of International Training Learning Center in Belgrade. Her interdisciplinary research focuses on critical peace and conflict studies, memory politics, and digital memory activism. In addition to her book, Memory Activism and Digital Practices After Conflict, that we'll talk about today, her recent works also include chapters in Agency in Transnational Memory Politics and in Palgrave Encyclopedia of Peace and Conflict Studies. Orly, welcome to the show.
Hi, Eva. Thank you for having me.
Orly, I wonder if you could please tell us a little bit about yourself.
Yes, I think your introduction pretty much covers it. I have been based in Belgrade for almost 2 decades now, where I teach in the politics department of the Faculty of Media and Communications, and also, as you mentioned, head the Learning Center of the School of International Training, SIT. In my academic background, I received my PhD at the School for Conflict Analysis and Resolution, as called at the time, at George Mason University, now the Carter Center. And prior to that, I was a student at Hebrew University in Jerusalem for my undergraduate studies and my graduate degree from Tel Aviv University. So, in my work and background, I'm very interested in thinking comparatively about conflicts and in this particular work about the meeting point of memory, politics, and conflicts.
Yes, in your book that we're going to talk about today, you really focus on tracing this emergence of memory activism in the aftermath of conflict and war, and you focus specifically on Serbia after Yugoslav wars in the 1990s. How did you become interested in this area of research? And in the case of Serbia specifically, you note in your book that often you would get this question in Serbia, how come you're here? So how did you choose Serbia as your and form Yugoslavia as your field of research interest?
Yeah, okay. That's a very, very big question. I'll try to kind of enter it from different entry points that you offer. I still get this question often, by the way, to how come you're here, how come you stay? Initially, my entry point to my academic work here was my interest in anti-war activism in Serbia in the 90s. And also very much in very understudied phenomena at the time, the conscientious objectors and those who refuse to take arms and go to war. So that was initially my PhD project that started in the early 2000s. Now, what one would ask, how come Serbia, and how come I came to this very much from the first years of the Second Intifada in Israel, where this comparison between Serbia and Israel I found very much fascinating and interesting. And again, understudied. There were a lot of comparative work at the time, placing, say, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict with the Cyprus or apartheid South Africa or Northern Ireland, a lot of writings at the time, very little with the former Yugoslavia. And I think for my generation, the breakup of Yugoslavia, the violent breakup of Yugoslavia, was something that shaped our worlds at the time, especially once I got out of Israel and entered a PhD, in a sense of the legacies of this, the wars of the breakup of Yugoslavia. Now, more personally, I would say, and that has to do with my own positionality, I would relate that to my mnemonic upbringing, if you want, or my mnemonic socialization. Growing up in Israel in the 1970s and 1980s, very much being indoctrinated into thinking about our pasts, but also the present as it was shaping our political awareness, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, and the whole Palestinian narrative of 1948, which was concealed completely from our awareness. The Nakba was concealed from our landscapes, but very much also from our textbooks, conversations, for sure calendars, commemorations. And then being a student in the 1990s, and also kind of going through my own political education and political awareness, and entering also activist circles in those years, this kind of opened an entire unknown world to me, and especially this understanding of alternative commemorations, which then became very kind of present in the memoryscapes in Israel-Palestine. Yet when I entered my PhD project, one of my commitments intellectually were not to write about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And my work in political education has actually led me to work with young people from the former Yugoslavia, hence the interest then in first anti-war activism, as I mentioned, which in the aftermath of my PhD, in the empirical research I've done, even after, has led me very much to the understanding and shaping of this topic of memory activism.
Yeah, no, it's really fascinating how you draw those parallels between these two regions and how you came about to focus on these events, the 1990s in former Yugoslavia. Your research kind of is situated within this broader area of memory studies, but you specifically are interested in memory activism. Can you tell us a little bit about what you mean by memory activism?
Yes. So nowadays, the term memory activism is actually used by many of us in the field who write and engage with these challenges as we see them, as studying and writing about the meeting point between memory and activism, right? And actually, the idea that memory and its construction involves labor is hardly new. If I go back to Elizabeth Jelin's work that has shaped my thinking about the social disputes over memory, she's written even more than two decades ago about, as she, and I quote, like human beings who labor on and with memories of the past. And she looks, of course, at Argentina and other post-dictatorship societies in the Southern Cone. And so In the book here, I try to kind of advance our discussions in the field when it comes to memory work and later on the works on memory activism. And particularly, I propose a framework for the study of mnemonic practices as seen in memory activism through engagement with alternative commemorations and the analysis of the rituals and practices of memory activists, more specifically, examine the ways in which memory activists as local actors claim agency and space by establishing alternative commemorative events marked on alternative calendars. So this framework of looking at the calendar as a site of memory, but as a site of alternative and counter memory alternative commemorative events. And more specifically, I'm interested in memory activism as a branch of anti-war activism, or what Stanley Cohen called anti-denial activism. The question of denial was important for me. It was actually one of my entry points to the study of Serbia and activism in Serbia in the 90s through the presence. And then there's the works, I try to continue and develop works on and discussions on memory activism as we understand the commemoration of contested pasts, but outside the channels of the state, so off the state channels, as in the works, for example, of Ifat Gutman, and very much building on Anne Rigney's memory activism nexus, and particularly developing the thinking and understanding of memory activism, and then as it shapes to practices of what we call memory of activism, which we can speak about a little bit later. Mm-hmm.
Yes, these memories of activism and I guess point to this intergenerational aspect of your study of these traumatic events and how they are remembered by different generations. And you start the examination of memory activism in Serbia by focusing on the generation of activists who were actually adults when the conflict first started in former Yugoslavia, so it broke out in 1991. Can you tell us a bit about who members of this first generation of activists or memory activists were in Serbia, and how did this their form of activism, what was the form that their activism most often took?
Yeah, so first, maybe a word on this generational lens that I chose to use. This is very much kind of shapes my methodological approach throughout the book, and proposing this generational lens as a means to actually delve deeper and gain more insights into the shifts and nuances in the practices of memory activists, right? And I think the fact that this work has spent over a longer period of time really allowed me to trace these shifts that are still ongoing, I would say, probably. So as in your question, really the first generation is and I look mostly at the group of the women in black and their street actions and street activism, because that's the main interest that I took in thinking of commemorative practices as they also appear and shape urban public spaces, right? But at the same time, it's a much larger a circle of activists. Some of them have withdrawn into the offices in doing, even during the 90s already, documentation of war crimes as those were happening, and in the aftermath of the after 2000 continue to spread that. But all of that is the kind of has to do with the dissemination of alternative knowledge. And the first generation, indeed, they came of age during Yugoslavia. Some of these, the leaders of these groups were mostly women, feminist women. Some of them were already in their, let's say, in midlife, in a sense, and sort of the violent breakup of Yugoslavia as it begins kind of takes them to the streets in anti-war actions. And also, you know, there's this distinction between those who were against the war and against militarism and took this position against nationalism, and there were those against the regime, and these were not always kind of the same, right? So, and from this particular group that was engaged with anti-war activism during the 90s, what I saw emerging was after 2000, after the end of the, let's say, what we call the Milosevic era, sort of the common sense say was that October 5th happened, but October 6th never right. sort of arrived, right? And therefore they begin to engage with the past and with the contestations about this past that for them is very much was witnessed by them and part of their own experiences, hence also their kind of slogan, Not in My Name, which is one among many slogans of the women in blacks, which I understand also as a generational statement, right, which the next generation can no longer claim as such.
I was wondering if you could maybe just share with our audience who are not familiar with this history, who are Women in Black?
Yeah, so the Women in Black began in the early 90s in Belgrade, as emerging from previous feminist circles and actually still in Yugoslavia, the beginning of feminist activism, I would say, but very much from the beginning, also taking the position of anti-militarism and anti-nationalism. Of course, the work also entails issues that have to do with patriarchy and gender equality, and very clear claims at the time, since the early 90s, against the war. And they model after the Israeli Women in Black.
Yeah. Where that's another very interesting point of connection there.
Yes, this was actually one of my entry points. From the Women in Black in Israel, and if you do activism against the occupation in Israel, against it, it's a question of generational belonging. But at least in earlier days, the Women in Black were very central and important in their Friday demonstrations around the country against the Israeli occupation, and so the Women in Black were taking some of the practices, which was very interesting for me, the silent vigil, the one-hour silent vigil, and they were practicing this as against the war in downtown Belgrade, right, at the height, let's say, of the war in Bosnia-Herzegovina. Then this was my earlier work, also tracing what happened to their practices, for example, when they couldn't take the streets during the NATO bombing or what leads to the war in Kosovo, right? So there's also different shapes of activism during the 90s and different practices that they were doing. But very much from there, one-hour silent vigil against the war grew and has developed later on during already the 90s, but very much afterwards, this kind of what I see as the alternative civic calendar, right? As placing on an alternative calendar, alternative to the state calendar, events that are otherwise silenced or unwanted, what I call the unwanted memories, and still the same practice of the silent vigil, with very clear claims that they hold in their banners, and also one of their practices, again, taken from the original Women in Black in Israel, which also have chapters around the world, but they have taken it in a very interestingly and rigid way of you never respond to passers-by. So even if people curse you and spit at you or what have you, you stand silent and you make your message clear. And this was, among other things, what I analyzes the works of the first generation of memory activists. And of course, the interesting moment is when different generations would join these practices over time and how then they kind of get their nuances or change a little bit.
I was quite fascinated to see that connection between feminist activism and histories of feminism and anti-war movement that sort of happened at this point. I was wondering if you could just reflect maybe on one thing, on one point that you made, that anti-regime and anti-war activism do not necessarily overlap, or those sentiments don't always overlap in this moment. Can you maybe expand a little bit? What you mean by that?
Yeah, I mean, I think this was already a discussion that I wrote about initially in my dissertation, and then it kind of also continued to develop as I was thinking about memory activism. Well, there were the 90s, as was written about in Serbia, is also a decade of civic action and very large protests. And as Marina Blagojevic has written about it in her important work in Serbia, one can trace, she says, the 90s through the demonstrations from 91, 96, 7, and eventually in the 2000s, right? And so in these different years and different leadership that has led these demonstrations, from students' demonstrations to the 2000s, let's say, in Otpor. The main claim, and I discussed that in the book, was kind of mostly to get rid of that regime that was seen as creating this abnormal life in Serbia, right? Mm-hmm. And especially in the late, you know, when it culminates in 2000s, and the culmination of that is October 5th, you have a lot of actors in the street in front of the parliament building, and there's a lot of political agendas there, from very right wing to very left wing, right? To at the time, what allowed them to stand there together was, of course, the insistence of getting rid of that regime. But you know, the women in black, when they were there with the rainbow flag, with the Pacha flag, they were always saying we were there, and they could contain us, right? But we did not agree necessarily with those in the front lines that came with a different political agenda, right? Yeah. So for example, in the analysis of Otpor, and in speaking earlier on to Otpor activists, many of them were not anti-nationalists, for example, necessarily, or didn't take that position against the war, necessarily. And also in the aftermath, when engaging with these questions, for example, the legacies of an event like Srebrenica or Vukovar, or concealing the silences about war crimes in Kosovo, these were not on the agenda of those anti-regime protests at all, as they themselves attest.
That's very much the case that you point out in your book, that this movement, anti-regime movement, was far more layered and complex than what we necessarily acknowledge. And of course, that is reflected in the memories and memory cultures that come after. You mentioned this phenomenon that you termed alternative civic calendars. Can you tell us about what you mean by that term, and share some of the examples of these alternative civic holidays or memorials? Yeah.
Commemoration. So my thinking about calendars, as I mentioned, very much came initially from being a part of this kind of activist circles in Israel, as to do with the emergence of alternative commemorations in the 90s. But here in Serbia, what was interesting very much was that the creation of an alternative calendar needs to, of course, begin with looking at the calendar, right, itself, the state-sponsored calendar. And this also goes back to works of Evyatar Zrubovel, who offers us to think about the calendar as a site of memory, right? And the calendar, of course, the cycle of the year, the mnemonic communities as they choose their dates on the calendar, and the nation and the nation state would be one of those. And so first, it requires, which is part of what I do in the book, is to look at the new post-Yugoslav calendar of Serbia, which very much is still emerging, right? Even last year, there was a new holiday introduced, there's the flag, and still, who knows where it's going. So as doing research in this fair is very interesting, because I was actually tracing that new calendar as it was becoming, which is pretty fascinating. It's not set, it's not done yet, it's still kind of in the making. The alternative calendars placed next to can then be analyzed in light of the, let's say, state-sponsored calendar, because in those that I propose to analyze, it's pretty much taking the events from as relates to the 90s. By the way, we can also analyze other alternative calendars, as, for example, those who still celebrate Yugoslav holidays. These are also now alternative, or
that's
issues
right.
related to contestations of World War II. I focus on the contestations of the 90s, and then the alternative calendars, in a way, it's the choice to take certain events that otherwise are being denied or completely silenced. They're, for sure you won't find them as they are on the calendar of the state calendar today. And around them, the actual practices that create certain rituals, right? And so around dates on the calendar, you also create certain joint action and rituals that make those kind of repeat themselves year after year. And as I mentioned, the women in black in their alternative civic calendar, as they place events from the 90s and insist on certain events that otherwise the new generations would not even hear about or know very little about, or know very little about only from the one perspective, right? And so the alternative calendar creates this kind of a platform for alternative commemorations and rituals, but also the dissemination of alternative knowledge and engagement with that very much. You asked for examples. So the Women in Black, by the way, also, they actually print a calendar. They have their own print calendar, which they give. But I, of course, understand it as a much as a calendar that has to do with the actual practices and awareness, let's say, of those who participate in that. As I argue in the book, the main event around which this calendar has been created today goes to the commemoration of Srebrenica, the crimes committed in Srebrenica, and the insistence on remembering the victims as victims of genocide, right, in downtown Belgrade, which is otherwise still officially denied. And they usually gather for a silent vigil on Republic Square on the 10th of July, and then they participate in the commemorations in Potocari on July 11th. But throughout the year, they also gather on other dates from events such as remembering Vukovar, or remembering the beginning of the siege on Sarajevo, or more recently remembering Suvareka and the crimes committed in Kosovo in the late 90s.
Yeah, it's fascinating how you describe this space of really unsolidified memories. On the one hand, these new dates that people are quite not sure where they're coming from, relating to often kind of distant past or church calendars sometimes, or completely new form of holidays, like this day of flag that you note. But on the other hand, the lack of really visibility of some of these dates, and to the point where the newer generations are not even sure what they, or may not be sure what they refer to. I'm interested in this next generation that you talk about in your book, this cohort of memory activists who were born in the 1990s, and they may not even have direct memories, or in fact, they don't, of these conflicts in the early 90s, the start of the Yugoslav wars. And their memories of conflict are more readily associated with the events in Kosovo, the war in Kosovo, and the NATO bombardment of what was then rump Yugoslavia.
This episode is brought to you by ServiceNow, the AI platform for business transformation. AI is only as powerful as the platform it's built into. Enter ServiceNow. It puts AI to work for people, for employees, for developers, and even your customers, removing frustration and supercharging productivity. On our intelligent platform, AI isn't just a promise. It's happening today. That's why the world works with ServiceNow. To learn more, visit servicenow.com/AI for people.
Can you tell us a little bit about this group of memory activists?
Yes. So actually, in my very early days, when I was still doing my research in Belgrade, that was 2004, 2005, right. I came across the Youth Initiative for Human Rights in Serbia, which was then just formed. And that was, since then, they, of course, became a regional network that exist in the post-Yugoslav states today, and they very much also cooperate with each other. In my work, I focus on the Youth Initiative for Human Rights in Serbia, mostly, and their engagement with memory, right? And so they do a lot of other things and a lot of actions, yet this particular aspect of their memory activism was pretty fascinating to trace, as to see how they had to give meaning to the previous actions that were out there already and create those as belonging to their own generations, right? So one of the things I noticed later on is around 2015, when they came with their own slogan, too young to remember, determined never to forget, which kind of sparked my interest in developing further this generational lens, because in some ways they could relate to some of the existing practices of the first generation, yet they had to tweak those to as relevant to their own positions and mnemonic upbringings, etc. And you're indeed, if you're born in the 80s, in the early 90s, the wars in Croatia and the wars in Bosnia Herzegovina are not living memories, and possibly the war in Kosovo is something you have a memory of, and particularly the NATO bombing, right? And the 78 days of the NATO bombing is very clearly today positioned on the official calendar of Serbia. Yet to even think critically of some of these events and to uncover the silences of those wars that they have no memory, living memory of, is very much the task of those younger activists, even more so the next generation of those already born even after the 90s, right? And so what I try to trace was the shift that they're making, the different entry points, and their interpretations and engagement with these pasts, but also very much with these legacies of these pasts, right? As they have received as the younger generation. And we can talk more about it. One of the things is the changes in practices, for example, choosing to commemorate Srebrenica on the 11th of July, the day itself, and instead of going to Potočar itself, staying in Belgrade and still kind of having a commemorative event here. To also kind of new forms of digital activism, where they use hashtags and social media very much to kind of disseminate alternative knowledge.
Yeah, so you make mention of actually moving your book from this on-site to online memory activism. And I was wondering if you could tell us a bit more about this concept of hashtag memory activism and how some of the examples of that you've kind of worked through. Yeah.
Yeah. So hashtag memory activism, which I put forward as a framework, actually I see as allowing us to trace the growing prevalence of digital memory activism and online commemorations on social media. So more than me searching for it, it just began to emerge
right.
as I was working and on these issues already. And it's very much, of course, also relates to the connective turn in memory studies, but I would say much more broadly in the social sciences, right? And I define hashtag memory activism as the online commemoration of contested pasts on social media, utilizing hashtag as a mnemonic practice. So for me, the hashtag and hashtag memory activism is actually a mnemonic tactic, and I analyze it as such, that enables and even strengthens the creation of alternative platforms for remembrance, very much through the sharing and disseminating of alternative knowledge about contested pasts. And it can be in the midst of conflict, but of course, in the book, I'm interested in the aftermath of conflict. So hashtag memory activism and online commemorations are never isolated online actions, right? And we have to approach them and see them as part, sort of a broader analysis of memory politics as it falls also on site itself. And so there is kind of this, what happens on site, but also let's trace it, allows us to trace it in the actions as they appear online. And I would also add that maybe hashtag memory activism, we can see how memory activists actually deploy hashtags, but not only as in order to mobilize people to join them in street actions, right? And there's literature, a whole literature about hashtag activism more broadly, but to a greater extent, hashtag activism is a platform to share and spread alternative knowledge, very much counter memories of difficult pasts, or what I analyze as unwanted histories and unwanted pasts, right? Mm-hmm. One of the things I find very interesting, if we can give some examples, of course, is if we trace the genealogies of hashtags, right? And this allows us to delve a little bit deeper to the analysis of memory politics. So, for example, in the hashtag, I take a number of hashtags and analyze each as a case study, from Not Our Heroes, which is, again, our as the generational belonging of the second generation who are grappling with the legacies of the ICTY and the war criminals and the return of those from... convicted war criminals.
I was wondering specifically if you could tell us a little bit about Not Our Heroes hashtag, because I think when you mentioned the first generation, the slogan that kind of marked that generation is Not In Our Name. And this one, I sort of felt there was a connection with this slogan of the next generation, Not Our Heroes, as well. So maybe you can tell us a little bit more about that phenomenon of return of these people from The Hague to Serbia, but also other countries of the region.
Right. So not Nisu Naši Heroi, Not Our Heroes, was a hashtag actually that I saw first utilized and used by the Youth Initiative for Human Rights in their regional actions, right? So this is also kind of my entry point to the next point we can discuss about regional memory activism. But Not Our Heroes was very interesting to trace at the time when the ICTY's work was coming to an end, the closure of the ICTY, but also as we saw in the entire region, and this is not only in Serbia, convicted war criminals are actually coming back home and being received as war heroes, right? And you could see it in some graffitis in the cities where we live, or and the engagement of memory activists from this position of their generational belonging was very interesting for me. Who is our, not our hero?
That's right, that's right.
And I can read that through the generational lens. But this means that this requires, and that was one of the questions that I asked activists to understand, this kind of position of not our hero. Of course, this requires engagement with knowledge about these crimes committed and about this past, which is, again, available through other means, through commemorative events, but also engaging with this knowledge by searching then who are our heroes, right? You have to the spin of that is to search for those who are, whose legacies they want to take after or look at as kind of models for their engagement as civic actors, as young younger people in their communities. And that also has to do with the search, of course, for hope in memory activism, which I also kind of write about in the book. And so to search for who their heroes are also kind of lays the foundation of memory of activism, right? So to take the generation, the first generation of the anti-war activists as and their actions and the price one paid for taking this position in their society is something I understood they find inspiration in and hope from, or in their work, as I write about their work on the Merdita do Bardan Festival, which is a festival that kind of bridges between societies in Kosovo and Serbia, Pristina and Belgrade, the work of the legacy of a person like Bekim Fehmiu, who was, let's say, a Yugoslav person, and the way his life ended, very much kind of they took inspiration in the legacy of his life, not necessarily at his the way it ended. So not our heroes kind of tracing that and where does it begin and what are the messages that they're conveying throughout that, I see as sort of hashtag memory activism. There's other examples, of course, that I analyze from It Did Happen, like, again, like these contestations of the past, or Sedam Hiljada, the 7,000, the call for the 20th anniversary of the commemoration of Srebrenica, and the building on previous work and further that I've done with Katarina Ristich about the White Armband Day and kind of continuing to think about that as hashtag memory activism.
You know, that's really fascinating the way that through these hashtags you enter this point of hope, which is kind of a very important part of your discussion. But you also touch upon the question of regional activism. Your book predominantly focuses on Serbia, but inevitably you broaden that out and explore memory activism in former parts of Yugoslavia. Tell us a little bit about this evolution of regional activist network. Did that exist in the first generation? Is that something that happens with the second generation more clearly?
Yeah, okay. So as I said, the thinking about the region and so there's work on region of memory and regions of memories. There's actually a book that just came out about that. But I kind of entered more thinking about the regions of memory activism and memory activists. Of course, the Women in Black, for them, the region was not, it wasn't a region, it was their country.
That's right.
Was Yugoslavia, right? So to begin with, in their identities as Yugoslavs, their anti-war position was very much thinking of the region. I mean, I remember my early work and interviews about you know, discovering what happened in Sarajevo during the siege, or going back to Sarajevo first time after the war, and the images and impacts of that. I don't think they thought they used the terminology that I'm using as regional memory activism.
Right.
For them, this was kind of very much one country that ended the way it ended, very violently. I think for the newer generation, when you're being born in Serbia and being your mnemonic upbringing is already very, very different, right?
So that's right.
To exit the national narrative only, or this sphere of Serbia only, and begin to move in the region also entails unpacking a lot of what you grew up on, and at times even discovering things that you were not aware of. So of course it has to do with political education and rise of political awareness. So the notion of thinking of the actions on the regional level, I try to put vis-a-vis other forms of regional cooperations, and there are many of those, particularly as related to the 1990s. Of course, I'm very interested, and that happens, it has to happen on the regional level, and it does when what we see is kind of activists who establish platforms for alternative commemorations that sometimes even mirror each other, right? If you see the memory of Oluja in the Operation Storm, the way it's being celebrated in Croatia and nowadays mourned in Serbia, and of course the politics of that. So in the alternative interaction with that, both in Croatia and in Serbia, sort of activists almost need each other to make through their action as alternative commemorative events, but also informing what I borrow from Atena Atanasio's work, what she calls the networks of commemorative solidarity. Right, and camaraderie, and sort of this possibility to engage with memory and discussions of memory, not only from the position of being a victim, right, and politics of victimizations and the narratives of that, but actually in offering other platforms to engage with this past from the position of, let's say, empathy. And instead of dehumanizing the other, actually showing, remembering victims and humanizing them, which otherwise is not available in this broader sphere of commemorations as it's being shaped in the entire region. And that, of course, is not unique to the post-Yugoslav region and this competition over victimization or the inability to see the other side as a victim too, right? So these kind of actions very much I discuss as, in the broader sense, as these kind of platforms for commemorative solidarity. And then there's the particular shapes of that in as we see it here in this part of the world. Of course, to go back to the initial interest in memory activism too, engage with anti-denial work and anti-war, or for even work for peace. Of course, anti-memory activism, there it can be understood in a much broader sense, but this particular angle of that to promote, let's say, more tolerance or more compassion or empathy, this is something I think is missing from the discussion very Absolutely. Often. And I kind of saw the need to bring it into this framework in my writing.
Yeah, I want to touch upon this point, which I think is probably the hardest point in your book and in thinking about this phenomenon of memory activism. And that is the question of how do we recognize the suffering of the other side? And then how do we move towards what you've termed commemorative solidarity? I mean, how do we talk about Srebrenica, right? The genocide of Muslim population committed by Serbian forces, but not talk about Oluja, which is the exodus or the storm exodus of Serbian civilians from Croatia. I guess I was wondering if you can share some of these examples of strategies that are used by memory activists to create that sense of empathy, to create, to move beyond these ethno-national forms of engagement with these legacies and shape some kind of a common regional memory scape.
Right. So I would say the practices themselves that I discuss in the book and as I was able to follow over the years, of course, there is the actual silent vigil as a practice, as street actions, right?
Yeah.
But the actual going, crossing the borders, today we're talking about crossing national borders. And I think the crossing of the border is also crossing on your of your own imagination and your own boundaries, if you think of where people grow up and how they're being kind of educated, mnemonically speaking, into these frameworks, even going to Potocari on July 11th, I analyzed as a practice of even if you, so the women in black go there and they stand and identify themselves as coming from Belgrade and being against the war. But in the earlier days, for example, the younger activists who went there didn't necessarily stand there and identify themselves. They blended into the crowd. Right. There is a religious ceremony. There is a ceremony that follows. But even the challenge in doing that or the strength in doing that, in showing solidarity with the other is something I was able to trace. And there are different examples of that, as you mentioned in your own work, as to do with Omorska, the same kind of the practices of going there. So these kind of alternative dates on the calendar, again, become also regional and meeting points for different commemorative actions and practices, the White Armband Day as such, where people kind of show their empathy and solidarity by an action that happens online, right? So this is also kind of a practice and a tactic that I show. Educational work that takes young people, say, to visit unmarked or marked places where crimes were committed. And again, very often, if you grew up in your own town or region, you may have not heard of those, or you heard of those only in relation to your own victims. And again, this is we see at the regional level. And I think the work of memory activists in sort of enhancing this practices of empathy and solidarity and camaraderie also requires kind of meeting each other in a sense of crossing the border and crossing your own boundaries in our minds and imaginations.
That's right. So it's both physical but also imaginary crossings in a sense. It was really fascinating to read the way that these activism and collaboration that has to do with memory and the region's violent past also evolves into other lines of activism. And you mentioned environmentalism and anti-fascist movements as well, and feminism. So we slightly go back to where we started in a sense, where we talk about the emergence of anti-war activism out of other forms of activism. And now we see that those connections kind of re-emerging again. So I was wondering, where do you see the future of this activist practice in the region? Does it broaden out in different directions, I guess?
You mean particularly of memory activism in the region?
Yeah, memory activism, that's right.
Yeah, because
it seems that they are moving into other areas of,
Well, that's what I try, like the one of the chapters in the book is grappling with this challenge, like, and I think that's question of activists who ask themselves this question, like, are we going to be able to continue in this work, or will it die out, right? I think a lot of people are grappling with finding hope and seeing the fruits of their work while the reality becomes sort of less accommodating to their claims, right? in that sense, I finished the book in discussing the unwanted past seen and unresolved present, right? It's ongoing. It's not over. I want to be optimistic and think that if this continues to evolve and if the younger generation, the younger activists will also become engaged and be able to put forward their claims, there can be the continuation of that. But placing memory activism next to other forms of civic activism was important for me to do for a number of reasons. Among others, sometimes there's lack of internal solidarity between these activists. You know, they won't necessarily support each other in their actions and claims, and there are plenty of those today. On the other hand, of course, when you see that happening, how a group that actually is committing to deal with issues of the right to the city and environmental issues also see the importance of acknowledging the work being done by first the anti-war activists and the anti-nationalists, and then what became the memory activists. So in that sense, I expect maybe to see more engagement with memory of activism as it will shape actions in the present and in the future. For activists who don't necessarily only deal with the past, you know, this tension between looking backwards or looking to the future, but what there is to learn from what was done so far over a number of decades of activism and the legacy of that, and also the weaknesses and the mistakes of this movement, which again needs to be discussed as part of looking forward, maybe. But I think there's little of that we see now, say in urban public spaces. There's no street names. There's no names of squares, of gathering places. So this work also kind of lays the ground to say, wait, there's some. We're building knowledge. We have practices that were done already. How do we move forward from here? To stop and do that, of course, is not always what you have time for and energy for. But I think and that's, I think, the value of sort of this ethnographic work that traces this work over time. It allows more to emerge than just what we see on the headlines, right?
Yeah, that's right. Lovely, thank you so much for sharing your research with our audience. And I was wondering if you could tell us, what are you working on at the moment?
Yeah, so again, thanking you, Eva, for having me, and it's a pleasure to talk to you today. At the moment, there's few things I'm working on or trying to work on. sometimes depends on the day how it looks. Currently, I'm co-editing a book with Sarah Ginsberger that deals with commemorations during COVID. We both started tracing some emergence of the memory, kind of thinking of what will be the memory of COVID, but also what happened to commemorative events during COVID itself. And it's going to be a book that will come out next year with Palgrave. And we have about 12 chapters, each discussing different geographies and practices. So very interesting work there. What led me to this particular work was, and that's another thing I'm working on now, again, continuing to think of alternative commemorations and alternative commemorative practices. But now, what if I can look at it more broadly and bring more regions and cases into the discussion? So one of the groups or practices I'm looking at is the joint Israeli-Palestinian Memorial Day commemoration, which was actually what first brought me into this alternative commemorations. It's a joint Israeli-Palestinian commemoration that went online completely during COVID, but even wow. before COVID went online because of the inability of Palestinians to enter Israel and particularly Tel Aviv. And so, again, searching for thinking of hope and the alternative commemoration as a practice that creates sort of a platform for hope in a place where many activists already feel pretty defeated, right? And so that's something I'm trying to think of, as well as the grievability, more kind of to bring from Judith Butler's work on the ability, again, to see the other and the sort of practice compassion and empathy. So these are kind of the main two things I'm currently working on.
Well, they both sound really fascinating, and I hope that you will be back on New Books Network once those pieces of research are out and ready. Orly, thank you so much again for being with us today and talking about your work. It was a real pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you, Eva.